Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
See something interesting. Take a picture of it with your phone. Upload. That idea right there? That's worth $1 billion. Facebook is buying Instagram, as you may have heard, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 9th of April. Good as always to have you with us. There are a couple of numbers that are going to get us going today. The first is $1 billion, as in $1 billion. That's how much Facebook is going to pay in cash and stock for the mobile photo sharing company Instagram. The second number is 2, as in 2 years. That's almost how long Instagram has been around as a company. Third and finally, 12, give or take. That's how many people work at Instagram. You roll all that up together and you get, really? From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman has the story.
Instagram launched its free app for iPhone less than 2 years ago and for Android smartphones only last week, but it already has 30 million users. That makes it the biggest company Facebook has bought so far. And it's a valuable social networking community to acquire, says Molly Wood of CNET.
Everybody kind of wants to get at these particular kind of geeky hipsters who have a lot of influence in the tech community, and all of those people are on Instagram.
And she says what those hipsters think is so cool about Instagram is its photo filters. You can make your pictures look like 70s Polaroids, sort of nostalgic and semi-professional, before you upload them. Technology analyst Carl Howe at the Yankee Group says even at $1 billion, this acquisition makes sense. Facebook has been slow to reach mobile users and has offered some pretty clunky photo sharing tools to consumers.
They like to share photos. And this has really replaced much of the family photo album.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said in a post today that Instagram will continue to operate as a separate mobile app and social network. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The other big corporate acquisition of the day is decidedly less Web 2.0 than Facebook and Instagram. AT&T said today it's going to sell a majority stake of its business directory unit to the private equity firm Cerberus for $750 million. Business directory is a fancy way to say yellow pages. And yes, they still do get printed and dropped on your doorstep every so often. But $750 million? How can that be? Mark Garrison has that story.
To report on the yellow pages, first I have to find a phone book. The last place I remember seeing one was in tall stacks in my apartment lobby, wrapped in plastic and untouched. Building Superintendent Jimmy Copeland hates seeing them pile up.
They sat there for a long time, maybe 2 or 3 months, and then you had to wind up throwing them in the garbage. Because nobody uses them books no more. We're on the internet now.
The internet is also where Brett Lentine looks for customers. The owner of Pure Luck Tea Bar in Brooklyn has no plans for a phone book ad.
I would never give them a dollar. I wouldn't give them a penny.
To find more iced, organic, locally made kombucha drinkers, he markets on Yelp, where he can give would-be customers more information.
They have reviews. They have the map function. You know, you can get directions, photos.
It's no secret AT&T's Yellow Pages unit is losing ad money to sites like Yelp, Google, and Groupon. Still, with 150 million copies in 22 states, it brought in $3.3 billion last year. Cerberus is the latest investor to try to tap Yellow Pages' gold. Private equity firms have bought directory businesses from phone companies before, including a $7 billion deal for Quest's unit a decade ago.
I've used the analogy to a melting icicle or a melting iceberg.
Charles McGill worked on a number of big acquisitions before joining NYU's business school. He says public companies like AT&T have to think about quarterly earnings, so they worry about the iceberg shrinking. Cerberus is private equity without the same pressure to grow each quarter, so it's happy to have what's left of the iceberg, the cold cash. I finally find a phone book at the last line of defense for the printed page, the public library. The phone books aren't far from the encyclopedias, two endangered species huddling together. I open it up and see all the ads from plumbers, lawyers, antique stores, and other businesses. The yellow pages are also online, but Forrester research analyst Nate Elliott says attempts to compete with Groupon and Yelp have fallen short.
the reality is they're starting basically from scratch. The fact that, they were dominant a few years ago doesn't carry any weight. They would need to first catch up to what all these other services are offering online.
Cerberus says it'll try to grow the online business, but Elliot believes that would cost a fortune. Once a vital resource, the Yellow Pages may end up ridden into extinction by a private equity firm named after a three-headed hellhound. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street this Monday, it was actually last Friday. We'll explain and we'll have the details as well when we do the numbers. As Wall Street digested Friday's kind of meh unemployment report today, 120,000 new jobs, as you heard, politicians are realizing this fall's election might still be about the economy yet, and in particular, how to get the millions of people looking for work back to it. In the New York Times this morning, Motoko Rich reports that a lot of the retraining programs that might help that happen are running out of cash. Motoko Rich, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to skip down, I don't know, three or four paragraphs into this article and start with maybe the most remarkable thing about this. We are spending less now on job retraining than we did back when times were good.
Exactly. So when we had an unemployment rate of less than 5%, we were spending about 18% more on training in real terms. So that's adjusted for inflation, which just seems a little odd. You would think that we have 6 million more people out of work, yet we're spending far less on retraining.
Why? Right?
We've obviously living in a very incredibly fiscally constrained time. And so that's part of it. And so a lot of the funds for training have been steadily cut over a much longer period of time. So it wasn't just after the recession that the money was cut. And there was, in fairness, quite a big of a boost from the stimulus. But after the stimulus funding, as we know, there just wasn't a lot of political juice out there for more increased government spending.
Right. So just to be clear, it went up with the stimulus and then came back down. And now net from the better times, it's still down, right?
Yes.
It does seem to me, though, that every time Congress talks about the extension of unemployment benefits, and yet I don't recall a whole lot of discussion the past 3-4 years about job retraining and whether to cut that spending. And you say it
not
has been cut.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. There hasn't been a lot. We've had so many debates over whether and for how long to extend unemployment insurance rather than increasing a budget to try to help people get back to work. And I was actually talking to Betsy Stevenson, who was the chief economist at the Department of Labor up until recently. And she described it, we're spending all this money on unemployment, but not enough money on re-employment.
Yeah. Do we know whether job retraining actually works? I mean, economists kind of can't make up their minds, right?
Part of the problem is there has been very little sort of very scientifically rigorous study done on this topic. So the Department of Labor is actually funding a massive study right now that's being done by Mathematica, which is this nonprofit. And they're studying training at 28 locations around the country and then trying to determine whether the people who go through the training actually A, get jobs, and B, get well-paying jobs.
Just to be clear here, what kinds of retraining programs are we talking about?
We're talking about anything from, you know, say a certificate program to become a certified nursing assistant, which would probably take 4 to 6 weeks, or to get a commercial driver's license to be a truck driver, or on up to getting a nursing degree, a full RN degree.
A whole nursing degree. I mean, that takes 2 years.
Yes, it does take 2 years. And so in all likelihood, the money would probably help you on your way with some of the tuition at a community college. A lot of this is done in conjunction with local community colleges. And that's another point. Community colleges are completely overrun with applications and students who are standing in line to try to get in for this job training. And in a lot of places, they can't get in. There's like a waiting list for the waiting list.
Motoko Rich, she's an economics correspondent for the New York Times. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
The mild winter we're getting out of now is a welcome surprise to a lot of people in the East and the Midwest this year. Less snow shoveling, lower home heating bills, among other benefits. Warmer than expected weather, though, wasn't so popular with all the companies out there busily drilling for natural gas. They've got a glut of gas on their hands, and they're running out of places to put it. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports now from the Sustainability Desk.
Talk about a natural gas explosion. In the past 5 years, U.S. production has shot up nearly 25%, says Chris McGill at the American Gas Association.
to a point today where actually the United States is the largest producing natural gas country in the world.
But supply is currently outstripping demand, and the surplus is quickly filling up the nation's underground storage facilities. We're talking mostly depleted oil reservoirs and aquifers. Some analysts say unless production falls off a cliff or demand spikes this summer, we could run out of storage space by fall. Analyst Amber McCullough says energy companies have already slowed down natural gas production and are focusing elsewhere.
Companies are dramatically shifting drilling toward oil plays.
A better investment right now since oil is selling for over $100 a barrel. But McCullough says once the natural gas glut is consumed, she expects prices to bounce back along with production. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
All right, so would you rather have $5,000 right now or the chance at $10,000 if you win a coin toss? Right, give me the $5,000, right? The bird in the hand, as it were. But there are certain situations when even the highly cautious become willing gamblers, not so much in the casino, in the hospital. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Here's a tough question. If you had cancer, which of these treatments would you choose? Traditional chemotherapy that could guarantee an extra year or two of life, but no more, or an experimental drug that could extend your life by at least 4 years, but had only a 10% shot of working? A study in today's issue of Health Affairs asked over 100 patients that question.
And the clear majority wanted to take those hopeful gambles instead of taking a safe bet therapy.
Darius Lakdawala is director of research at the Schaefer Center for Health Policy and Economics at USC. He's the author of the study. He tells me this question isn't just an academic parlor game. It's a real choice.
And in fact, it's the way the world is going, that more and more cancer drugs are designed to benefit select subgroups of patients and to work really, really well within those subgroups, but not necessarily for every patient with the tumor.
This brings up one of the most challenging and expensive questions in end-of-life care. Insurance companies are reluctant to pay the full cost of drugs that can run up to $1 million and help only a small percentage of people. Doctors, he says, also can push patients to traditional therapy, where overall the odds are better.
They don't really think about what happens to the luckiest few that might derive the greatest benefit.
But patients do think that way, and most would trade the long slog of chemotherapy for just a slim shot at joining the lucky few. Lakdawala says if our hospitals reflected the world that patients prefer, we'd see a lot fewer people coming in for chemo and a lot more people at home with crossed fingers. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This is my Titanic cocktail. In it, we have Titanic 5-year whiskey, fresh apple juice, fresh lime juice, some velvet falernum, plenty of ice.
Yes, plenty of ice. Money, too, though. But first, let's do the numbers. On the first trading day since that disappointing jobs data on Friday, the Dow Industrials gave back 130 points, about 1%, 12,929 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ descended 33 points, nearly 1.1%, 3,047 at the bell. The S&P 500 sheared off 15 points, about 1.1% there as well, closed at 1,382, the S&P did. The Dow's fourth straight pullback was led by weak financial shares. Bank of America slumped more than 3%. Citigroup withdrew more than 2% today. Industrial stocks didn't fare a whole lot better. Caterpillar shares dug deeper by more than 2%. Stock in General Electric short-circuited around 1.5% today. Bond prices rose. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.05%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for February. Check out anything good lately from the library. Tomorrow is National Library Workers Day. Or how about a good flick? Dr. Zhivago, say, Omar Sharif turns 80. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. My accountant is a very nice guy, totally helpful. Of course, the half hour I spent with him today getting ready to file my taxes, still excruciating. 30 minutes, though, is nothing. By some estimates, Americans altogether spend billions of hours, yes, billions of hours doing their income taxes. For all the stress April the 15th brings, though, there are lots of other taxes that don't take up much time at all. In fact, most of us barely notice them. And Marketplace's Eve Tro explains that's no accident.
If you have not done your taxes yet, like me, you might wake up this week in a cold sweat over it. But that's a bit irrational, financially speaking, because most of us pay more in other taxes than we do in income tax. If you look at life through tax glasses...
Well, every day is tax time.
Oh boy, fun, right? Well, Katie Pratt, a tax expert at Loyola Law School, does see the world that way. Taxes all around. You might pay tax when you turn on the lights or brush your teeth, or when you walk into your home. Property tax. There's a vehicle registration fee, about $80 a year for my old tan Chevy. That is a tax, but it's called a user fee. Pratt says no one really throws a fit over it.
People object less to user fees because they can associate some benefit with the payment of the fee.
Cars need infrastructure. Traffic lights, emergency services, the licensing system. Makes sense for drivers to fund that. And when I stop to fill up the tank,
it's $4.45 a gallon for regular.
The tax on the gas goes to pay for roads, but it doesn't show up on the receipt.
We all know these days to the penny how much a gallon of gas costs, but most people have no idea how much the excise taxes on gasoline are.
Excise tax, more than 18 cents per gallon from the feds, almost double that when you add California state gas tax and a sales tax on top. All that's included in the sticker price, not listed separately. When I buy a few items in the mini market...
So I got some gum, some juice, which I'm going to shake up and drink, and there's no tax.
In California, at least. But sales tax at restaurants? Yes. 35 cents on my $3.75 breakfast burrito.
Can I get a receipt?
Pratt says we might pay thousands of dollars in sales tax each year, but never feel the pinch.
You're less aware of them because you're not filing sales tax returns. You're just paying it in dribs and drabs here and there.
And some taxes consumers actually want, like the federal, state, and local taxes piled on to cigarettes.
You know, a thumb on the scale encouraging them to not smoke.
Government leaders have gotten more savvy with how they package and sell taxes, says Edward McCaffrey. He studies tax behavior at the University of Southern California Law School.
The income tax is the worst possible tax from the government point of view. It's the most salient.
Meaning we feel it and resent it the most. We hate filling out the forms. We go ouch when we see that grand total at the end. Double ouch if we owe and have to write a check. But we pay much less attention if the money's taken out of our paychecks, like with Medicare or Social Security.
Most Americans, about 80% of Americans, pay more in payroll taxes than in the income tax.
Politicians figured out they could raise that without too much fuss. President Obama was the first in decades to lower payroll taxes, a move most Americans barely noticed since it led to a trickle of extra cash instead of a lump sum rebate. The U.S. has also raised corporate taxes in lieu of income tax. McCaffrey says we unwittingly pay those, too, because...
They have to pass that on.
So if I go for coffee...
Could I get a grande non-fat latte?
The company's taxes may show up in higher prices, lower wages, or fewer employees.
You have to wait longer in line, and time is money, so that's a cost.
As it's become politically taboo to raise income tax, McCaffrey says government relies more heavily on these other types of revenue. He says income tax has stayed about the same percentage of GDP since the 1940s.
While other taxes, more psychologically favored, more hidden, have been going up and up and up.
But sitting down to tally all that would take a lot longer than doing my income taxes. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Taxes are a fraud. I'm not speaking as a Tea Partier or an Occupy Wherever 99%er. I'm speaking as an ordinary taxpayer with a 1040 form, a bill from my accountant, and a headache.
Commentator PJ O'Rourke.
In theory, taxes should be like shopping. What I buy is government services. what I pay are my taxes. I'm not worried about whether taxes are too high or too low or whether government services are worth it or not. That can be settled in the voting booth. I'm worried about the shopping itself. It's supposed to be a simple transaction. There's a thing to buy and a price to pay. I pay the price, I get the thing. But the relationship between government services and taxes isn't so simple. According to the Government Printing Office, the menu of government services as listed in this year's federal budget is 2,403 pages long, and the U.S. tax code is 16,845 pages. I'm left with no idea what I've got in my shopping bag and not a clue about what's going on at the cash register, which brings us to an often neglected principle of economics. Complexity is fraud. If we can't make head or tails of what we're buying, how can we be sure what we're actually getting? We saw this writ large in the 2008 financial crisis. Subprime mortgage-based collateralized debt obligations and all sorts of other exotic derivatives were being bought and sold. We can argue, however lamely, that these products were not meant to cheat the public. But because of their complexity, that was the result. And this kind of convolution is all around us. Consider Byzantine airfare pricing, bewildering cell phone service packages, the impenetrable math of figuring out whether it's cheaper to lease a car or buy one. Nobody seems to understand what he or she is buying or selling anymore. And nothing is harder to understand than what the government is selling us with the federal budget, except how we're buying it with the federal tax code. I'd complain to my congressman, but I think he wrote part of the damn thing.
P.J. O'Rourke is a political satirist. His most recent book is called Holidays in Heck. Send us your thoughts about taxes or whatever else you hear on the broadcast. Our website is marketplace.org. April the 15th is not only traditionally tax day, this year it's something else as well, the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. And until not too long ago, the city where she was built, Belfast, Northern Ireland, didn't want much to do with the tragedy in which more than 1,500 people were killed. But then, with centennial celebrations coming up, they changed their minds. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard reports now from Belfast.
So roll up, get your tickets, please, for the Titanic, about to depart in the next 10 minutes, ready for launch.
This is not the Titanic, of course, but the Titanic Explorer. A less than luxurious bus which tours the shipyard where the doomed vessel was built. You might think Belfast would be embarrassed about its Titanic connection. Not a bit of it, says the tour operator Connor Cobb.
We do have a saying in Belfast that Titanic was all right when she left here. We're not to blame for this tragedy. You can make a beautiful Mercedes-Benz, but if the driver runs it into a tree, it's not really our fault.
Good morning and welcome to Belfast. Today we are going to see a birthplace of legend.
In recent weeks, Titanic tours like this have proliferated. Once, Belfast was rather reticent about its infamous ship. Now the city is going overboard about it. Just open, a huge new $150 million visitor attraction which tells the full story of the ill-fated liner.
At noon on April 10th, bang on time and fully expecting to be in New York within a few days, the Titanic sounded her whistle and cast off her lines.
Titanic Belfast is housed in a new building shaped like the hulls of four ships. It's just been launched with almost as much ballyhoo as the vessel itself 100 years ago, spokeswoman Claire Bradshaw.
Unfortunately, for many years, people have known our city for the troubles, for our political conflict. Titanic Belfast is about putting a new slant on Belfast. It's about becoming this new city. It's an iconic structure. Titanic Belfast is now the jewel in the crown of our city. It's our Eiffel Tower.
The centre recreates not only the horror of the sinking, but also the energy and excitement of the ship's construction and launch. Bradshaw claims this will have a twofold effect. Not only helping turn Belfast into a major tourist destination, but she says it will also rekindle Northern Ireland's pride in its industrial past.
We want to take our place back, back as we were in 1912. We want to take back our city's place in global business, in global industry, and really put us back on the map for all the right reasons.
Belfast has a long way to go. It does have some light engineering industry, but even after more than a decade of peace, the province is still heavily dependent on British taxpayer support. However, the city has embraced the Titanic centenary and is determined to cash in on it.
This is my Titanic cocktail. In it we have Titanic.
Jamie McGee and his family renamed their pub the Titanic and launched a special Titanic cocktail.
Some velvet falernum, some aromatic bitters.
No ice.
Oh, there's plenty of ice.
Belfast is awash with Titanic products, Titanic menus in the restaurants. There's even a Titanic brand of tea and Titanic potato chips from, the makers claim, the world's best chipyard. Some critics say this is tasteless, but the city is also hosting a sombre commemoration. And William Blair, who runs this serious exhibition called Titanica, says Belfast has every right to make money from the ship.
The story of Titanic is very much about business. It was a hugely important project for the city. Now the city, I suppose, is seeking again to capitalise on that. Titanic is not just part of our past, it's part of our future.
One could just wish them well and say full steam ahead, but that might be tempting providence. In Belfast, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we go back to whence we started, Facebook buying Instagram for $1 billion. It is, as Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg said in a blog post today, essentially a social networking deal. So it does seem fair to ask social networkers what they think of it. That's what the Wall Street Journal did today, a Snap Online poll. Suffice it to say, Mr. Zuckerberg has some hearts and minds yet to convince. There is a link to some of the reaction on our website. It's marketplace.org. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gave back 130 points, 1%. That was essentially Friday's news, the jobs report. As you know, the NASDAQ off 33 points, not quite 1.1%. The S&P 500 down 15 points, 1.1% there. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, Fiona Ng, and Jolie Podokis. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.